public testimony of the subcommittee on a public hearing for House Bill 3386. And I would invite Brad Higby and Rob McCray to come testify. As they approach, committee, this bill deals with the statute of ultimate repose, which was passed in the 1970s. And since I've been here, we have created two exceptions to it, one dealing with breast implants and the second dealing with side saddle gas tanks, both allowing for pursuit of a lawsuit, even though the statute of ultimate repose has expired. The chair's justifying or justification in doing that is that in those cases, the proponents of the bill have been able to show that the condition that existed was known to the manufacturer, and that yet the particular piece of equipment was not recalled, and in fact they continued to produce it without correcting it. My understanding in this particular matter is that this situation with Mr. McCray meets those criteria. So, Mr. Higby, if you could identify yourself and please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I guess, and Brad Higby on behalf of the Justice for Rob McCray Committee. And with me is Rob McCray, and I'll have him say a few words in a minute after some introductory remarks, Mr. Chair, and then I'll follow up after him, hopefully with a few more remarks, and be happy to answer any questions that you all may have. But as indicated in the testimony that's being handed out, and I'll just briefly summarize, Rob was involved in an unfortunate accident about a year and a half ago. He was working for the gas company, unloading sections of 40-foot-long sections of pipe, when the crane that was lifting those sections of pipe off the flatbed truck contacted an overhead power line. The coursing electricity went through the crane, the cable, the pipe, and Rob, who was standing on the ground, essentially grounded. And he's had to go through quite a bit since that time. We're alleging that the manufacturer should have included some basic safety features widely known about, widely in use and available since the 1950s, that would have meant that Rob would still be on the job right now, not here today. I'll get into this a little bit, Mr. Chair, following up on what you had indicated about the statute of ultimate repose. On page 2, I cite some of the information regarding the nature of the law in other states, and in particular the law that applies here in the state of Oregon. It is an 8-year statute, and I've copied from the statute, section 30.905, which describes the applicable portion of the statute. Very simply, what that essentially means is that once a product is 8 years old or over, a manufacturer is completely off the hook. What we're asking for you today, and I will turn it over to Rob here in a second, Mr. Chair, what we're asking for you today is simply an opportunity for Rob to open the courtroom doors to make his case, to make his argument that the manufacturer was at fault for producing this allegedly defective product. We're not asking you to agree with us necessarily that this is in fact a defective product. We're just looking for an opportunity. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rob, and when he's done, Mr. Chair, I'll get into a little bit more detail about some of the evidence presented in my testimony. Rob?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Rob McCray. I'm here today to give some testimony about my accident, my life as a result of this accident, and what I believe are the reasons that could have been prevented. This accident could have been prevented if certain things had been included in this crane package that subsequently electrocuted me. On 9/7/97, I went to work. 9 hours later, I was in the hospital with 12,000 volt electrocution burns and resulting in several amputations, severe third-degree burns over almost 50% of my body. As I believe the cranial fracture was at fault by not providing equipment that is relatively inexpensive. And this piece of equipment, the insulating devices that are available commonly, they were not provided in this unit. So basically what I'm here for is to try to send a message down the pipeline to the manufacturers through this law, through this House bill, so that other people are not injured like I was, so their families don't have to go through what we've been through. I open to any questions if you do have any questions at this time.
Panel, why don't we hear the rest of the testimony from Mr. Higby and then open it up to questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief, and maybe before I actually pick it up, Rob, if you wanted to maybe talk about some of the safety features. On page 3 of the testimony I've distributed to you, I described the two basic essential fundamental safety devices that would have prevented any of Mr. McRae's injuries, the insulated link and the proximity alarm, also known as the proximity warning device. Mr. McRae was employed with another utility that the manufacturer of the cranes that were supplied to that utility were fitted out with these two safety features, and perhaps almost as an expert witness, Rob, we can talk a little bit about how they actually work.
Pacific Gas and Electric, where I was employed before, it was a standard feature of any electric or gas department crane units to have insulating blocks or insulating links on the cable assembly. And they were very effective in their operation. Not to my knowledge were they tested very often, but they were in place to protect the workers. And unfortunately, this was not the case in my injury, my accident. I would just for people in the future, I hope this message can be sent to the manufacturers. It's so easy just to provide that insulating device. And I don't know any other way to send a message. I'm just one guy.
Well, I know from my law practice and the construction firm I represent that the proximity alarm, all of their equipment that is used around power lines has that alarm.
Absolutely.
And, of course, there's also, I don't know if it's a written rule, but it's definitely a rule that because of the potential of an arc between the line and the equipment, you're supposed to have a certain distance.
The 10-foot rule.
The 10-foot rule. And generally, you have two employees, one to make sure that there's someone observing so that when you're concentrating on operating equipment, that if you get too close, there's someone there to say, look out or be careful.
Well, in the state of workforce reduction, that's not always the case. And people depend on the equipment to have the backup to provide a safety factor. Yes, these devices, the proximity alarms, are inductive devices. They're not battery powered. There's no failure rate really about them. They operate at all times. You know, they're always there, and it's just so inexpensive to compare to my injuries and what it cost my employers to get me to the stage I'm at now. I'm well over $1 million.
And, Mr. Chair, just to then use that as a point of departure, it is true that there might be some rules that say do not get within 10 feet of a high power line, but regrettably, these sort of accidents happen quite frequently. This is not the sort of thing that you could simply regulate and say, don't do this. Human behavior is such that through depth perception, even of a spotter, you're not going to tell exactly how far the line is from the end of the crane. The sun could be in your eyes, could be obscured by trees or other structures in the area. You could be diverted momentarily by focusing on a load that, as the operator, you're trying to move. There's some natural human behaviors that are reasonably predictable that you could take care of by having some of these basic safety features in place. Proximity warning device, even the inattentive operator will be reminded visually and audibly that they need to stop the crane immediately because they're getting too close to the power line. That's far more effective than saying, please don't get within 10 feet. Similarly, the insulated link non-metal device that would stop the flow of electricity coursing from the power line to the crane to the cable, and in Rob's case, they continued on down the line to the pipe he was holding and guiding off the truck through Rob. Let me just say that the significance of cranes coming into contact with power lines is not a trivial matter. We're not here just because, as Rob is indicating, he's had to suffer mightily through his own experience, and he would very much like to have his chance to have a day in court. But these are not just the rare, infrequent occurrences. As I've indicated in my testimony on page 3, they happen quite often. In fact, 115 deaths a year occur in the United States when trains come in contact with high power lines. Similarly, there are 200 or so serious permanent injuries each year that occur when trains come in contact with high power lines. Many thousands more suffer other sorts of injuries. As I've indicated there in the testimony, most of the folks that are injured are the people that are on the ground guiding the pipe off of a truck or some sort of a vehicle. It's not the operator. It's the guy that's standing down below when suddenly something like this happens to him. So it's quite significant. It's not a rare occurrence, and it's going to happen again. Hopefully, sending a message to the manufacturers, it's going to be worthwhile for them to include these sort of products in the safety devices and the products they manufacture and deliver. The safety features have been proven to be effective. They work, as we just described. They could have stopped all of Mr. McQuay's injuries, and he wouldn't be here today taking up some of the committee's time. These devices have been widely discussed in the literature. People have known about them. They've been used since the 1950s. As I've indicated in page 4 of the testimony, a number of various governmental and other entities have touted the benefits starting as early as 1957 that, as I've described there, I guess that's in a document that was submitted in 1958, that insulated length and proximity alarms were must on cranes. And unfortunately, that's from a 1958 article that's entitled Crane Contacts Can Kill. The crane industry itself was well aware, at least in 1970, when an insurance company did a specific study and found that an incredibly high incidence of injuries occur when cranes do come in contact with high power lines. And in fact, as I've indicated there, 23% of all workers' compensation claims occurring in connection with mobile cranes result from cranes coming into contact with high power lines. With that, Mr. Chair, I just might add that I know that there's been a lot of discussion about the whole statute of ultimate repose. I know that doing something differently in that regard has not enjoyed widespread support in previous sessions. We're coming to you with a relatively narrow proposed exception to that statute. On behalf of Rob and his family, I should have introduced his wife and stepson who are in the audience with him, but also, as Rob said, because this is going to happen, unfortunately, again to other Oregonians and other people unless there is some sort of message that could be sent. And it seems like the burdens on Oregon business are greater under these circumstances. As Rob had mentioned, medical bills alone are significant. His employer, former employer, Northwest Natural, is on the hook for a fairly significant workers' compensation responsibility. If the manufacturer, which in our view is responsible for these circumstances, can be invited into a discussion and held accountable, the Oregon employer, through a third-party claim, can get reimbursed for all or a portion of the workers' compensation obligation that otherwise they're out of altogether. Again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would urge you to support this bill. We're not asking you to agree with us that these particular circumstances are, in fact, what would result in a conclusion that these products are defective. We're just looking for an opportunity. We just want to have a chance to make our case. With that question, thank you.
Senator Carney.
I just say no when you get through your testimony. We'll move the bill to the floor immediately, which is a statement about how we feel about the issue and the least we can do is try to deal with this issue. So that's going to happen, just for what it's worth.
Other questions?
If not, thank you for your testimony.
Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's not like I was planning on being here in the race, but here I am. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Representative Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Mannix from Salem, and I appear here today most humbly as the co-chief sponsor with Representative Winters of this legislation. I was very appreciative of Senator Courtney's remarks, and I do not want to take any extraordinary amount of time. I simply would urge this committee to consider the carefully limited language of this bill, which allows an opportunity for justice in this particular case. And I am available for questions. Otherwise, I thank you for your consideration.
Questions for Representative Mann? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I would then close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 3386.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3386 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved House Bill 3386 to the floor due pass. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Motion passes, and Senator Courtney now carry the bill. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3194 and invite the Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a great little bill that passed through the House. It would make a significant difference to a lot of people. We have a unique opportunity here to send a piece of legislation to the floor that is grounded in common sense and is a result of communication and compromise between two groups that have differing views on the open adoption records issue. As you know, the recent passage of ballot measure 58 would open up the birth records of children in Oregon who were given up for adoption. While it is true that measure 58 is still tied up in our court system, House Bill 3194 is a way to help parents who want to express their interest in being contacted. House Bill 3194 creates a contact preference form for birth parents who gave up a child for adoption in Oregon. The form would allow a birth parent to express one of three things to the adoptee. One, that they wish to be contacted. Two, they wish to be contacted through an intermediary. Three, that they prefer not to be contacted at this time. The intention of this form is to allow the birth parent an outlet for the expression of their preference for being contacted and to give additional information to the adoptee about the wishes of their parent. It is important to note that this is a voluntary form that in no way would affect the implementation or original intent of ballot measure 58. The expressed wishes of a parent are non-binding and are only intended to serve as an initial point of communication in a system that is now devoid of parental input. And the burden is on the parent to obtain and complete the form, which would then be attached to the birth certificate record. Our office has received dozens and dozens of letters and emails from parents and adoptees in support of this measure. We do not know of anyone who is opposed to this legislation. This bill came to my office at the request of seven of Oregon's most prominent private adoption agencies. There were several representatives of these agencies. There are folks in the back here. We're here today. House Bill 3194 also has the support of the Chief Petitioner of Ballot Measure 58. House Bill 3194 abides by the spirit of Ballot Measure 58 while adding a voluntary provision for birth parents to communicate their wishes regarding contact with the adoptee. Such a simple idea, and it seems to mean a lot to a lot of people. I hope that you will support it and pass it on to the floor for a vote. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Kiersey?
You want to look?
Yes, Sam Burdick.
Oh, just if you know of any more detail about where the legal challenges to this stand and when we might get a resolution.
Well, you can probably answer that question better than any of you know where the legal challenge. Do you want to talk about that?
Let me do this. We have five other witnesses, and you're probably one of those.
She is.
So if you could hold your question and ask the next panel of witnesses, we'll probably be probably have our answer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll invite James Wheeler, Kathy Ledesma, and Phyllis Nash. They don't work on the same time.
It is also very good.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, my name is James Wheeler. I am the Director of Columbia Adoption Services. I'm also the chairperson for the Legislative Committee of the Coalition of Oregon Adoption Agencies and past president of that organization. My agency, along with the six others that Representative Piercy mentioned earlier in her testimony, drafted this initial bill. We worked with the Bureau of Vital Records in terms of the mechanism for how this could work if it was passed, and then came up with a bill that we submitted to the legislature. During the process on the House side, some of the support groups for adoptees and birth parents came forward and added input. And we came up with a bill that we think is really a good bill. It does allow, as Representative Piercy indicated, the opportunity for, in a sensitive way, for for birth parents who may have planned a confidential adoption 40 years ago to indicate what their preference is now, whether or not they would wish contact. We urge your support for this bill. As Representative Piercy said, we know of no one that's in opposition to it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear from the panel of witnesses before we open it up for questions. Who would like to go next?
Okay, thanks. Chair Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Program Manager for Adoptions and Permanency Services at the State Office for Services to Children and Families. Before I go through my very short prepared testimony, I do want to offer an apology. Somehow, between my rough draft and the final draft you have before you, a short paragraph was omitted. It doesn't really affect our position on the bill, but did want to tell you that you're going to be hearing something you're not seeing. 3194, as Representative Piercy explained to you, would allow the birth parent to complete a form indicating their preference regarding a contact by the adoptee. The form would be attached to the birth certificate by the Center for Health Statistics when it's sent to the adoptee. If the birth parent indicates they don't want contact, they must show proof that they've completed an updated medical history and have it filed with the Voluntary Adoption Registry. Here's a little paragraph that was omitted. We're directly affected by this bill in two ways. First, along with others, we would be required to distribute the birth parent preference form when it's requested by the birth parent. The workload impact of this activity for SDF would be minimal, and we don't think that there is any projected fiscal impact for us. SDF is also directly affected by the bill's provision that birth parents submit an updated medical history form to the Voluntary Adoption Registry. In addition to creating that form in cooperation with the private agencies and the bar, we administer one of the registries, and we would experience a moderate workload impact as a result of the submission to us of additional updates on medical history records. I would like to interrupt my formal testimony by saying, very interestingly, we have seen a marked increase in the number of people placing their names on the registry since Measure 58 came into being. In the last month, we've had about 40 people placing names on the registry. In addition, we would be required to issue to the birth parent verification of receipt of these records. And again, we don't think that either of these activities is going to have a significant workload or fiscal impact for us. In summary, we now support 3194 in its present form, and we'll be following any further bill development, and we'll want to offer further testimony if there are further amendments. And I'll be glad to answer questions at the end as well.
My name is Phyllis Nash. I simply represent families, mine in particular. I am birth mother. I want my child to have rights. I'm asking that you support this bill so that my daughter can, in fact, get access to information regarding me. In my prepared testimony, one of the things I talk about is, as a birth parent, particularly birth mothers, we change our name. My name at the time I gave my child up for adoption was Williams. I've since gotten married. My name was Nash. How is she going to find me as a Williams when I'm no longer a Williams? Additionally, I've gotten married again, and my name was McManus. However, I kept my name Nash, so at least she has some sort of traceability, but trying to get to me with three name changes is almost impossible. In addition to that, both birth mothers and birth fathers have a problem in that we move out of state, we move out of town, we move to other places. Birth children have a problem trying to find those parents as they move on to new lives, to new locations, to new places in the country or outside of the country. In addition to that, siblings will now have a way to contact birth siblings as a result of being able to leave information. If I leave my name, my daughter can eventually, if she chooses to do so, be in contact with her brothers, one of whom is here to help support the bill as well. In this age where families are torn apart by divorce as well as by adoption, this gives family members a chance to have a history to draw on. We all have a need to belong. We all need to know about medical history. We need to feel like we belong to a group. It's unfortunate that the last time I testified happened to be the same day as the Littleton incident in Colorado. There were people trying to feel like they belong. They needed a group to belong to. Adoptees want to feel like they belong as well. I'm not comparing adoptees to the people involved, but it's a significant issue in our day and time that people want to belong, and adoptees in particular, in a lot of cases, seek to find out who is it they came from, what group was it that they were born into, their natural parents and their natural family. Both parents and children would have options by this. I, as a birth mother, could say, I don't want to see you, and here is the reason, or I can say, I do want to meet you, and here's the circumstances under which I want to do that. It gives the birth child the right to know. They can go and seek the information or not. That's their choice. It would be my daughter's choice to be able to do that. Then we have the choice to contact or not. She can contact me if she chooses to do so, if I register to do it. It's a choice that she has. We can build a relationship or not, but it's a choice. Right now, there is no choice. What I'm proposing is that this really helps give both of us the choice now instead of a blank wall. There's ways, but it's very difficult to get past those initial walls that we have today. We all make numerous friends in our lifetime, and one of the things that I've seen in the past is that people feel that if you have one parent, you can't have another. In this day and age of divorce, we're proving that to be quite the contrary. Instead of having one set of parents, a lot of children now have at least two sets of parents that they deal with and that they love. And it doesn't mean that just because I have one parent, I can't love an additional parent. And that's what I think this helps us do. I'm a firm believer that in this state, in this time, we don't have enough love in our world. It's evident by a lot of the strife. It's evident by our children who are having problems. And if by opening up these records, we can bring a little more love into the world, I think we'll all be better off. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Now, just help me here. I'm sure it's all here. This is for Oregon, right?
That's correct.
So the adoption would take place in Oregon, or the birth would take place in Oregon, or both have to take place in Oregon. What does it matter?
This bill affects a birth certificate that's created in Oregon. So if the child is born in Oregon,
right. So that can, if the birth took place in the state of Washington, even when the child left the hospital, if they were born in Washington, that certificate would not necessarily be on file with who here in Oregon that you're keeping this with? Who's going to maintain this, please?
Yeah, Senator Bryant, members of the committee, would be maintained with the Bureau of Vital Records here in Oregon.
That birth certificate would not come into Oregon, is that right?
No, I don't believe so.
Well, that kind of tricks you at all, isn't it?
Right, I don't believe so.
I'm the godfather of three adopted children, and I've gone through some recent examples of where older people have decided they want to reach their parents and traumatized the natural parents, and they had to work through that, so as whereas somebody else doesn't want them. So I'm just trying to get through all this. So that one doesn't follow. The key to the records is, I mean, how secure are these records in terms of confidentiality? So, I mean, is it just we just assume the people who work with these statistics know, or they kept in some way, or just can you help me with that, please?
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, my understanding is that the records are very secure. They can only be opened by a court order at this time. Those staff members who work at the Bureau of Vital Records, I would assume, have to take some kind of also confidentiality. They're working with some very private information, confidential information.
Okay, suppose a mother knew. Okay, so the child is born in Washington. The birth mother learns, and somehow she has this feeling the child has been moved to Oregon with the. Okay. And she comes into Oregon and wants to file the papers with vital statistics. Would the mother be able to do that under those circumstances? That would she guess right? The child has moved to Oregon. There's vital statistics. Would she be able to do that?
No. That's only.
You don't file
a birth certificate everywhere you move. Yeah, birth certificate removed in the
state you were born. But the adoption took place in Oregon.
But the record you'd affect would be the one
in
Washington. You go back to the place of birth to change the birth certificate at the Department of Vital Statistics, whatever they call it.
And Measure 58 does not allow an Oregon resident to get an original birth certificate from any state except Oregon. If it's an Oregon resident and they were born in another state, they can't use our Measure 58 to get their birth certificate from that other state.
Constitutionally, we can't impose that burden on another state.
Okay.
Could one of you answer the question? Probably it would be you, that Senator Burdick asked, dealing with where the litigation presently stands.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I really don't know. I know that Helen Hill will be able to answer that question.
We'll get Helen soon then. All right, thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you, testimony. Mark Fryer and Helen Hill.
It is a very tough area.
My name is Helen Hill, and I'm the chief petitioner about Measure 58 and the author of the measure and the director of the political committee that directed the campaign. And about the court case, it's currently under injunction still. Throughout the summer, there's going to be, I believe, two or three set dates for oral testimony and written testimony, and then responding to that. September 9th is the date for the court hearing and the court ruling by Judge Northrup, unless, of course, he opts for a summary judgment before that time.
It's Judge Northrup here in Marion County.
Yes. I love this bill. I love it because it preserves the integrity of Measure 58, which is something that the Oregon people voted in by substantial majority, and it doesn't interfere with that in any way. It expands the dignity of everyone involved in the post-adoption years. It's predicated on the assumption that direct correspondence voluntarily offered by the birth parent and put directly into the hands of the adoptee where it belongs, will help adult adoptees make even more considerate and careful choices about how to direct their own lives and their own choices. And I believe it's safe to say that the entire adoption reform community nationwide is watching Oregon carefully right now, because it's really exciting. The Oregon legislature has so far handled this with intelligence and compassion, and I urge you to vote this bill through today with no amendments or changes. And I think that we're going to really provide direction to the rest of the country here. We've been floundering in a bitter controversy over this issue for the last 20 years. And I'm really proud to be a part of this state and see what's happening here. And thank you. And if you'd like any more questions answered, I'm happy to do so.
Again, we'll wait for both witnesses before I'll have questions.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would just like to echo everything that's been said in favor of this bill so far. As an adult adoptee who has managed to find his heritage and reunite with his biological parents, I've outlined some of
your name for this.
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Mark Spreyer. I live in Portland, Oregon. And I've outlined some of my personal story in my written testimony to you today. And I would just like to champion this bill as a tremendous enhancement to Measure 58, and I see it as a very separate issue. I see Measure 58 as a adoptee civil rights issue in equal access, and I see this as addressing some concerns around searching, contact, and that sort of thing. Thanks for the opportunity to just be here and give a strong yes for this bill. I hope you pass it. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, and Bruce.
Thank you. I am a strong supporter of Measure 58, and I support this bill as well. But I did have a question, and especially directed maybe to you as an adult adoptee, and that is, are you at all concerned about the effect that kind of a two-tiered system would have on adoptees whose biological parents opted not to disclose? Does that concern you at all in terms of this?
I'm a little confused by what you mean by a two-tiered system.
Well, that's probably the wrong word, but basically this would give the discretion of the birth parent to say whether they wanted to be contacted in the future. So are you at all concerned about situations, the effect on adoptees when the birth parent has elected not to?
Certainly not. I spent 14 years searching for my biological family. A bill like this as a law would have satisfied some curiosity in a matter of minutes as opposed to years of searching.
No, I intend my question was, what if you'd known that your birth parent had an option to do that and chose not to? That's the situation I'm concerned about.
That would have been fine. I would have had no objection to that. It would have been empowering my birth parent to make a decision. It would have empowered me to make a decision about my birth parent's decision. It puts the control back into our hands rather than in a rather nebulous system which doesn't necessarily have individuals' best interests at heart.
I think if I can say something too, I think I'm detecting a misunderstanding surrounding this bill on your part when you say that it doesn't allow disclosure to happen. The adoptee, it has a right to that birth certificate no matter what. If there's a note attached saying that the birth parent doesn't want contact, there's still no disclosure that's been vetoed there. That adoptee gets the birth certificate. There's a lot of other information on it that they might want or need. And whether they choose to then contact the birth parent against the birth parent's wishes, again, that's the adoptee's choice. And it's something that's in the hands of the adoptee. There's no withholding of any information with the bill, only a confidential avenue for the birth parent to say what their preference is in the matter, if they want to be contacted or not.
Again, I support it. It's just an issue that came up in terms of how people feel in a very difficult situation sometimes.
Yeah. I think that it's very important how this contact preference form is written, and I was hoping that there might be a citizen input committee that could help write it, because I think just three boxes that could be checked off is a hard way for an adoptee to get a message. I think there should be lots of blank lines in it and lots of, you know, opportunity for the birth parent to say why they want contact or don't want contact. So I'm looking forward to how that form gets written. And I think there's a compassionate way to do it, because, like you say, it could be really hard for an adoptee to just have this box checked off, no contact, you know. That could be hard without an explanation.
During the campaign, I had a community town hall, and we did all the ballot measures, and I think you were unable to attend, and Dolores came in your stead, and she was just a fabulous, articulate speaker.
Yeah.
She had the crowd in tears, and she was just incredible. So you had good folks working with you.
All over the country, too. Yeah. Dolores wanted to be here today, but she couldn't.
Oh, I said hi.
Other questions for this panel? If not, thank you for your testimony. We will then close the public hearing on House Bill 3194 over the work session.
Chairman of House Bill 3194, A, and goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3194, A, and goes to the floor due pass. Discussion? Objections to order? Carrier, please. Senator Burnick, who cares? Yes.
I was in a meeting when you heard House Bill 3386, and I would like an opportunity to vote on that bill.
Without objection, Senator Brown would like to be recorded as an aye vote on 3386. It will not change the outcome.
Does this man know me or what? He knew, the only reason he knew is because he knew I would say it doesn't go far enough.
I just misunderstood.
Thank you for not offering any amendments that could have jeopardized the bill.
No. I've learned some lessons over the years. And I know how to count.
We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2876 and invite Trish Conrad and Sean Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Wooden. It's the 60 days, 180 days.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Trish Conrad appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors and the Oregon Apprenticeship Coalition. And by way of introductory reference, the contractors are more familiar to you than the other group. The Oregon Apprenticeship Coalition represents more than 40 training committees across the state, currently training in excess of 3,000 apprentices. And it is also on their behalf that I'm speaking to you today. So I could just a little detail about how we arrived at our current situation, how the situation is impacting those committees, and then finally how it's impacting the individuals who are serving on those committees. Some legislation was passed during the 1997 session that basically shifted the status of these committees from state agencies under the auspices of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, staffed by BOLI employees and receiving advice from and being represented by the state attorney general, to private entities. However, these private entities are now still maintaining the responsibility of implementing state laws and regulations and affirmative action, which has impacted those committees in a number of ways. The first is they found it very difficult to obtain liability insurance since they still have the responsibility for implementing sometimes controversial issues like affirmative action while having unlimited exposure. And when they have been able to obtain insurance, they've had to pay very high premiums, which many of the smaller organizations cannot pay. And finally, the impact on the individual has been that they now see that they have this unlimited exposure, this awesome responsibility, and they are very afraid of risking their own personal finances in that kind of situation. It's been very difficult for them to seek out and actually obtain these unpaid volunteers to be members of the committee. By passing this bill, you will extend the existing state limit, tort limit, to these committees and giving them the protection that goes along with the responsibility. I urge you to vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Sean.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Independent Electrical Contractors and the Associated Builders and Contractors. We do support House Bill 2876, our apprenticeship programs throughout the state. The statutes that, or the bill that Trish Conrad referred to was Senate Bill 45 of last session that took the apprenticeship committee out of and under the auspices of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. This bill, which limits tort liability, just simply puts the protection onto those apprenticeship committees for which they were granted before when they were under BOLI. I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Questions for these gentlemen, excuse me, this lady and this gentleman. You mentioned the implementation of affirmative action clause, and this is unrelated. As I recall, we're talking about it's not affirmative action in the sense of setting quotas. It's goals, those sorts of things. As I remember the statute, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. Hearing none, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2876. Open work session on House Bill.
Move House Bill 2876 then goes before with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the motion passes. Could I have a carrier, please?
I'll do it.
Thank you. No, but I twisted her arm.
Did you want to?
I don't want to fight.
Him.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Well, hey, that doesn't stop me from sharing those opportunities.
I know that.
Committee today, we won't have here 12:05. It'll probably be back on Monday. We do have amendments, and also we have agreements. So, also on Monday, we may be meeting at 1:00.
That's the new time.
That will be our new time. The President of the Senate, because most of the committees are closing on Friday, and he wants to go into session from twice a day, the second day from 3 to 5. So our option would be to meet between 1 and 3, or try to meet during session 3 to 5. Last session, we met during session, and it worked okay but not great because we get called to the floor and it's interrupting. But the challenge is I'm on another committee that meets from 1 to 3, so occasionally I'll have to excuse myself to probably go vote in ways and meets. But right now that's the tentative schedule. Does anyone else have a conflict from 1 to 3? I don't think anyone does.
Everybody.
Senator Q-Tub will, and so she's going to be replaced by Senator Duncan. So he'll become our seventh member. So we'll at least know him in a lose-lose when he comes here.
Carry all the bills.
That's right. Can we do that, Jerry?
Mr. Chair, and I know the Senate President talked about switching from 1 to 3 and then from 3 to 5, and it makes sense to me for our wonderful audience here that we have judiciary at the same time every day. That just makes it easier, I think, for folks. But.
Right, and if we get backed up or there are other complications, we still have the option of going in the evenings if we had to. The likelihood of that happening would probably be for some lengthy hearings dealing with Measure 40. There are going to be eight House Joint Resolutions coming over on that, which will take some time. We will have probably the bill dealing with parental notification, which Senator Courtney wants to carry. We will also have the bill, in fact, it's now been assigned to our committee, dealing with lack of treatment for children because of religious
beliefs. 494.
And so that is going to take some time, too. My hope is to move our hearing room downstairs in A, B, C, or D. Right, and I'd like it to be next to the Ways and Means Committee so that if I step out it, I can come right back. I'll miss the steps, but anyway, that's where we are. So those who regularly attend our Senate hearings, watch the agenda. We might be creating rooms. Sure. Okay. We will now go into work session on Bill 1007. And we have some amendments. Okay. Bob, would you like to support? I want to thank both Ann and Senator Brown for working on this for me and all those who participated in the work group, including Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll speak to the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments. What the Dash 3 amendments do is eliminate text of the original printed bill and replace it with some language that deals with our recommitment process. Right now in state law, a person could be committed for up to 180 days. At the end of that 180 days, there is a process in place to recommit them. Although that process probably does apply to people who are in community placement and under commitment orders, it wasn't clear in the law that it did. And so what this, the Dash 3 amendment attempts to do is to clarify that the recommitment procedures are available both for people who are in the hospital at the end of their commitment period and also are in the community either on conditional release, outpatient commitment, or trial visit, so that they can, there's a process to keep them within commitment jurisdiction. The Dash 4 amendments are somewhat modified version of what were the Dash 2 amendments, and what these intend to do is to provide an opportunity for families and other people who are close to an individual who has been held in a hospital awaiting a commitment or has been committed and is in a facility, would allow that close family member to get some information about the person. The main one being that the person is in fact there, and then some information about what their status is in the commitment process. And this addresses, I think, a serious problem. Many facilities have fears of liability just for releasing information about a person, any information, because the fact of just the presence in a psychiatric hospital can be a very stigmatizing piece of information, and if it gets into the wrong hands, such as an employer, it could have devastating effects for the person. However, that concern sometimes has left families in a situation where their loved one has disappeared, they don't know where they are, they call a facility, no one will tell them what's going on. This is an attempt to address that. We are supportive of both the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments, and Mark Gardner from the Attorney General's office is in support of the Dash 4 amendments. I know, as he told me. I think that just about covers it.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Members, maybe you've already said this, and if you have, I apologize, but one of the biggest differences between the 2s and the 4s, the 2s that you saw at your last hearing, is the permissive nature. It permits the facility to disseminate the type of information that Mr. Junebeck was discussing. It does not require them to do so.
Mr. Chair, I think it's, I may be speaking for some folks in the audience. I think folks are fairly comfortable with the Dash 3 amendments. I would suggest that there's probably some opposition to the Dash 4 amendments to that. This is sort of a new territory that we're creating here.
And I think I announced this at the last time this was up. In talking to our state agencies that deal in this area, and the fact that there was a Attorney General task force that had a broader charge than just this issue dealing with mental health and mental health issues. One of the things we need to look at in the interim as far as the judiciary will be this large topic and how we should address it as a legislature and as a public policy. And there's some good issues there that I don't have answers to at the moment. But that'll be something I think the interim judiciary will take a look at. And I understand the Dash 4 has come from Mark Gardner at the Attorney General's office. Is that correct?
No.
And Ms. Gingo. Okay, good. Other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We are in work session. So, and as I understand it, and we, the Dash 3s and 4s do not conflict, so that we send it off the vote, correct?
Yes,
all right. The chair then would move that we adopt the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1007. Discussion? Objection? So the chair then would move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 1007. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. The chair then would move that we adopt Senate Bill 1007 as amended to the floor be passed. Discussion, objection, so ordered. Would you mind carrying it? Just because I get emotional. Okay. And Senator Brown will carry it. Thank you. All right. Now I'll go into work session on Senate Bill 504. If you recall, we had conceptual amendments explained to us on this last time, and so, Ann.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the bill that, as amended, would provide an exemption to the statute that currently specifies how attorney's fees are awarded in cases, in actions of insurance actions. And with the amendment, the exemption would specifically apply to underinsured, uninsured motorists, and personal injury protection benefits. And as I think Mr. Bow testified at your last work session, the consensus was that the exemption from the statutory scheme for the award of attorney's fees would come into play in those three areas if, in writing not less than 6 months from the date that the proof of loss is actually filed with the insurer, if in fact the insurer has accepted coverage, and only the issues remaining are the extent of liability for the uninsured or underinsured motorist, and if the insurer has agreed to go to binding arbitration. In those two cases, or if those conditions are met, then in fact the cases would be exempt from the statutory scheme. I did point out to the proponents, and they have agreed, that the language in the Dash 4 amendments that's before you, although it satisfies their intent. I just had some concern with the way it had been drafted. If you look at page 2 of the -4 amendment, the conditions A and B apply in the cases of personal injury protection, as I said, uninsured or underinsured motorist benefits. I had some concern that the condition A, the second half of it, those issues would never arise in a personal injury protection instance, and so they have agreed in the House to better specify the fact that A and B actually will apply in the uninsured and underinsured motorist cases, and B will apply in the PIP cases. So they did give me the nod as they left the room to go to other bills. They were willing to do that in the House, but would appreciate you sending it there so they can accomplish that.
Thank you. No, I understand. It's a confusing topic. The Chair would move the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 504. Discussion? Objection? The word of the Chair would move Senate Bill 504 as amended. The floor be passed. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. I will carry. We'll now go to public hearing on House Bill 2304 and invite Steve Dingell.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bryant, members of the committee. My name is Steve Dingell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association to testify in favor of House Bill 2304, as engrossed and amended. And I believe it's referred to as with the -5 amendments. That's the version that's currently in front of the committee. I'd be happy to answer questions at the conclusion. My remarks are very brief. At least in Marion County, our experiences, we have a case every 7 to 10 days that involves these issues. It's my experience that this statute would simply codify and clarify for the courts what happens. It is not unusual at all for those reasons that are set out in that statute for cases to, or for this issue to arise. And this simply would allow a mechanism for us to resolve these cases and resolve them while the person is in custody, because what oftentimes happens, is that a person is released, they fail to appear for the trial, and the whole process starts over again. And I know there have, I've talked to Mr. Penn about this, there were some concerns, and I would point out that the -5 amendments do carry a sunset clause in there.
Clearly, I said this is a public hearing, it's a work session. We've had this bill before us at least two other occasions.
So the -5 amendments, House Bill 2304.
Before you do that, Senator, we have one printing error that the Chair would like to, Mr. Taylor, describe the printing error, and then I'll suspend the rules.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there has been a suggestion that we add on line 6, after defendant, comma, defense counsel, comma. So that would clarify, it would clarify the fact that not only the defendant, but the defense counsel could seek a continuance on those grounds. Otherwise, you may have the situation where the defense counsel is just appointed, and the defendant says, hey, that's my right, I want a trial tomorrow, knowing full well that no one can do it.
So the Chair would move the suspension of the rules to allow correction of this obvious oversight. Without objection, so ordered. Then, Mr.
Attorney. Move House Bill 2304. I move the HBHA amendment to House Bill 2304.
So with the correction on line 6 of adding after the word defendant, defense counsel comes.
Correct.
Thank you. Discussion? Objection to order.
Move House Bill 2304 as amended before the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Recording moves the amended bill to the floor to pass. Discussion? Objection?
I'm an objection.
Your objection?
Yeah. I may be okay with it. I have a few amendments, but...
Okay. You certainly like it better now than the way the House did.
I like it a lot better now.
Thank you. And I like sending the bill back to the House corrected and in better condition. Please note Senator Brown is objecting. Motion carries.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Senator Courtney.
Of course.
We'll carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, I accept out the rule for a moment and was absent when you voted on Senate Bill 504. I assume that was meant to be the agreement bill.
It was. Would you like to be recorded as an aye?
As long as it does not change the outcome. And if no one has any objections.
Senator Brown would like to be recorded as an aye vote on Senate Bill 504. It will not change the outcome without objection. So ordered.
We're going to meet at 1 o'clock from now on?
The goal is to meet at 1 o'clock, but we need... The goal would also be to have a room downstairs.
Room downstairs, okay.
So
tomorrow we start.
No,
we don't meet tomorrow. It starts on Monday. Tomorrow's Friday.
We're done?
I believe that concludes our agenda today. Let me look.
Tell me it's lost.
I have nothing for you. We are adjourned.